Hello boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen, this is Nishant and welcome to another episode of the Nishant Garg Show. This show is for people who want to live a life of excellence, love and joy. My mission is to bring awareness about transformation and healing. My job on the show is to invite the world-class experts to deconstruct the practices, routines and habits to help you live a fulfilled and abundant life. Every Friday, I share an exclusive email to the newsletter subscribers. And this newsletter captures my weekly learnings in the forms of books, blogs, articles, recent podcast updates, and much, much more. You can find the newsletter link at my website, https://nishantgarg.me, nishantgarg.me. And today's guest is Mark Hullman. Mark is an inner and outer explorer who has devotedly studied mindfulness meditation practices for 3 decades. He is passionate about sharing the power of meditation and has taught mindfulness workshops and meditation retreats in 6 continents for the past 20 years. Mark is a senior meditation teacher at Spirit Rock Meditation Center and has taught there since 2000. He holds a degree in clinical psychology and draws on his extensive experience in working with people as a therapist and a coach. Mark is an unabashed nature lover and through his organization, Awaken the Void, he shares his passion for integrating meditation and nature. He leads wilderness meditation retreats from Alaska to Peru, taking people on inner and outdoor adventures. Through Awaken the Void, Mark also leads year-long meditation in nature teacher trainings in the US. Mark is the author of 3 books, From Suffering to Peace, Make Peace with Your Mind, and Awake in the Wild, Mindfulness in Nature as a Path of Self-Discovery. In this episode, Mark explains how can we free from the inner critic, integrating mindfulness meditation with nature, finding peace in the body, mind, heart, and world, and from suffering to peace, connecting with nature and mindfulness, recognizing your pre-verbal traumas, somatic-based therapy, cultivating joy and happiness, and cultivating the quality of awareness. So without further ado, please enjoy this wide-ranging conversation with Mark Hullman. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
It is an honor to have you on the show. So I was going through your profile and there are so many things about mindfulness and meditation, psychotherapy, healing, and so much. So I was wondering I could start with by asking you your connection with kayaking and nature. How did you fall in love with kayaking?
Well, funny you should ask that, because this morning I went up, got up at 5 a.m. because I wake up with the sunrise, dawn here, and put my kayak into the water in Richardson Bay, which is a very sweet cove in San Francisco Bay, and floated out onto this glassy, silky, dreamy, you know, morning waterscape. And so, yeah, it's been a big love of mine. And how I got into it, actually, when I grew up in the north of England and I learned to kayak on small rivers up there and lakes. And yeah, just had a natural affinity to it. And then when I came to California, connected with what's now a dear friend, Bob Licht, and his company, Sea Trek, who run this lovely sea kayaking outfitter in Sausalito. And I suggested to him, I said, you know, how would you be interested in leading a kayaking and meditation retreat? And because they run these trips in Baja. And so he was game, and that was about 15 years ago. And so that's really deepened my love of kayaking, because we run these beautiful, you know, silent meditation retreats in this national park in the Sea of Cortez. And we're floating out into the wilderness with these wild, rugged mountains behind us and the sun rise in front of us. And it's just very gorgeous to be on the elements. It's something about being on the water. It's very primal. And, you know, it's also a great mindfulness practice, because it's hard. You know, you have to be mindful when you're doing those kind of activities. Otherwise, you capsize. So it's become a deep love of mine. One of the, you know, there's many portals into nature and you know, walking, hiking, running, and for me, kayaking has become one of those just ways to immerse myself into the natural world.
You mentioned north of England. Is it UK England or US England?
Yes. Now, I grew up in Northumberland, which is on the Scottish border in England. And it's a very wild landscape, wild windswept beaches and beautiful countryside. And that really was what first turned me onto nature was, you know, as a young boy, I was able to, you know, in that era of being able to go out and play in fields and along the coast and in the woodlands, and just developed a deep connection to nature as a source of solace and beauty and peace and refuge. And that really has stayed with me, you know, my life.
While growing up in England, was your family also connected to nature and mindfulness?
So to some degree, I mean, there weren't, you know, campers or backpackers, but they certainly loved gardening and loved, you know, being outside, and they would take me to the beach. And so I definitely learned a love of birds and becoming acquainted and falling in love with the nature around you. But it wasn't like going up to the, you know, hiking in the Alps or downhill skiing or scuba diving. It was very like, what, you know, connecting with the nature that's always all around us, including the bird song.
And when did meditation exactly entered into the picture of your life?
Yeah, so we moved south to London, just outside of London as a family. And I ended up going to college in London. And where meditation really took root was I was actually college. I was a punk rocker and kind of a wild child and a bit lost and confused and angry and was an anarchist. And I was squatting houses and quite political and kind of angry with everybody and blaming people left, right, and center, and was quite unhappy in myself and had a lot of unacknowledged self-hatred and inner criticism and I was unhappy. And I had some experiences that kind of started me searching for some way to find meaning and peace and trying to make sense of this crazy human life. And I happened to be living in the East End of London by a Buddhist center. And I was squatting actually one of the Buddhist center's houses at the time. And I got to know them, and they kind of, I think, kindly suggested that I go check out meditation. Maybe it'll help this poor, crazy young punk rocker. And so I did. I went to the center, and I immediately was struck by the quality of presence that the people had in the center. And I learned mindfulness practice and loving kindness practice, and was, you know, as one can be when you first start meditating, it's sort of transformative in that you close your eyes and suddenly this whole interior landscape wakes up, and this capacity to be awake and aware is revealed to you. And instead of looking outwards all the time that we do, learning this capacity to turn the gaze inwards and really understand the mind and why we're so unhappy, or why the mind is out of control, or why emotions are turbulent. And so it was very, very helpful to begin to, you know, understand myself through that process, which was, you know, beautiful and revolutionary. You know, I was looking for revolutionary movements, but the inner turn in meditation practice is revolutionary in itself.
How old were you when you visited that Buddhist center?
I was about 19, and yeah, really, you know, it was like I came home when I started meditating, and I dropped out of college and ended up moving into a Buddhist center in the country. And kind of began a lifelong journey of study and practice and retreat and meditation, and really trying to understand both Buddhist teachings and mindfulness and meditation practice, and also how to understand myself and find some peace, which was kind of elusive at the time.
Finding peace is always a lifelong process, never ending. And so you were 19 when you visited that Buddhist center, and you mentioned that you were angry, you had unacknowledged self-hatred. Would you mind if I ask you about what were the reasons of being angry and having self-hatred?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I think what I know now that I didn't know then is that many, if not most people, suffer from strong inner criticism and self-judgment, and often accompanied or fueled by a sense of not liking oneself or hating oneself. And I look at my journals and diaries at that time, and I was just riddled with this self, you know, bashing, self-chastisement, and putting myself down and feeling depressed and critical about that. And so, you know, exactly the etymology of that, it's hard to say, but what was clear was I felt persecuted by my own mind. And as a consequence, you know, felt quite unhappy internally. And my life was okay on the outside, but was clearly leading to feeling unworthy and shame and whatnot. And so it took many years of both cultivating, you know, mindfulness to understand what was happening in my mind, but also the second practice that I learned was the practice of loving kindness, and which helps, you know, develop self-compassion. It wasn't really until I started developing those practices that really started to both understand my mind and begin to diminish some of the negative impacts. Later, I went on to write a book about it because I found as a teacher that so many students plagued by these negative voices and these negative views. And, you know, there is ways, fortunately, we can find peace and freedom from those voices.
I want to ask one more follow-up question on this. Did you have any kind of childhood trauma behind your anger, depression, and self-hatred?
Well, at the time, I would have said no. And as trauma is an interesting process, later in my sort of meditation life, in my life, you know, probably maybe a dozen years after that time, starting meditation, I began to become aware of actually quite a lot of deep pre-verbal trauma that there was in my system.
Pre-verbal, right?
Pre-verbal trauma, yes.
What is that?
Pre-verbal trauma means trauma that arises prior to when we start speaking and we start conceptually understanding and classifying and labeling our experience. So basically, I'm not sure exactly clinically when what's defined as pre-verbal, but, you know, basically younger than a year old or when prior to speaking and conceptualizing. And so the challenge with pre-verbal trauma is there's no concepts around it because it happened prior to that, to the brain being able to conceptualize reality. So it's much more amorphous kind of trauma because there's no concepts and no labels, and it's more felt bodily in the nervous system and to some degree emotionally, and it's a much more sort of diffuse. Not always, but in my case, sort of diffuse kind of trauma that requires a lot of skill, you know, to work with, and compassion, self-compassion, and guidance, and so.
Yeah. Yes, and if I try to paint the picture of your life, where were you exactly in your life when you were really recognizing your pre-verbal traumas?
I was in the middle of a 3-month silent meditation retreat in Massachusetts at the Insight Meditation Center, which some of your listeners will be familiar with. They've been running silent 3-month retreats for, at this point, almost 50 years. And yeah, so I was in the 90s, I was doing a lot of intensive meditation practice. And, you know, months and months and months of silent retreat every year. And it was a beautiful, deep exploration into insight meditation and my mind and mindfulness and what it, you know, understanding what it means to be awake and to be free. And in the middle of that retreat, the trauma surfaced, as can do in deep meditation and also in silent retreats and also in any circumstance, really. my experience with, and this is all in retrospect, the wisdom of the body, the wisdom of the psyche generally knows how and when to release material, trauma or otherwise, that we in the past couldn't process, couldn't assimilate, and so stores it in the body and releases it in times when we are able to actually feel it and handle it. So that retreat became a deep, very painful exploration of that trauma and trying to understand that and try to bring some compassionate presence to it. And what was interesting for me is I meditated. So I'd been meditating about a dozen years by then. And mostly in mindfulness practice, awareness practices, and heart practices, compassion, kindness mm-hmm. practice. And what remained, you know, when this trauma erupted, and it did erupt in a kind of a volcanic way, it was really threw me, you know, flattened me for a while. But what remained, what was available was this compassionate presence, compassionate awareness. And so I felt like the summary, you know, of having done, you know, a decade or more of mindfulness practice, kindness practice, that what remained was this kind presence. And that really was what was the medium or the conduit for which the healing began. And so, you know, and then over the years, you know, worked through the trauma, understanding it, healing, integrating, and, you know, and then as I became a psychotherapist, it became a very important part of my work, helping other people and students. When I became a teacher, helping students, clients heal their own trauma. So the gift of the, you know, of that was it really allowed me to go very deep into suffering, you know, the human suffering, and really opened my heart to compassion for the tremendous suffering in the world, and also gave me an ability, a courage or a fearlessness to go anywhere with anybody, because the trauma that I went through felt, you know, as difficult and as dark as any place one can go in human psyches. So it, you know, it's a beautiful gift when you come out the other side, you have a certain kind of resilience and capacity and fearlessness to not be afraid of the psyche and the mind and where it can go.
In that Massachusetts center where you were going through the silent retreat, did you get support from others to work through your trauma?
To some degree, the awareness and understanding of trauma has really exponentially grown in the last decade. But in the 90s, there was, of course, some awareness of trauma, but not much understanding. And it's really, you know, probably in the last 10, 15 years, you know, with trauma-sensitive mindfulness and just trauma awareness, the work of Peter Levine, somatic experiencing, and mm-hmm. others that have opened up the understanding. So on a meditation retreat, the purpose of the meditation retreat isn't to be a trauma healing center. And there's not a silent meditation retreat for most people is not a great place to heal trauma, because, you know, most traumas are relational, and for healing to happen, it needs to happen in a relational situation, not on a silent, deep silent meditation retreat where people don't even look at each other. So it was a safe holding environment, but actually the work happened really, you know, after I left the retreat and did work with various modalities, including somatic experiencing and other bodywork modalities that allow sort of access to those sort of more energetic layers, like in cranial sacral therapy and whatnot. So,
yeah, thank you for explaining, Mark. So if I understand correctly, that meditation retreat helped you to recognize your trauma, and later on you did bodywork and somatic experience therapeutic work. Could you double click on somatic based therapy? Because I'm a huge fan of somatic based therapy. So people, for our listener who may not be aware of body work and somatic experiences, can you please share some details on this?
details like what it is?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, somatic experiencing, which is the main modality that, you know, I used and then trained in, and then I share a lot with my students and clients and teachers that I'm training. You know, it's a very simple mindfulness applied methodology where, you know, trauma is held in the body. And for resolution, we have to learn how to work with that trauma in the body. And the challenge, particularly actually, if we come at it with a meditation perspective, usually what happens is when trauma arises, it very quickly and easily overwhelms us, kind of floods us with information, emotion, stimulation, and often the immediate sort of experiences, we feel overwhelmed. And we lose the capacity to stay present. We lose the capacity to be with it with any kind of skill. And it's like it often feels like we're drowning back in those experiences that were originally traumatic. So the nervous system gets activated. The body moves into a fight, flight, freeze response. And so where mindfulness comes in really handy, and particularly as it's used with somatic experiencing, is really learning how we can find a way to stay grounded and regulated and steady in the midst of these strong, often, you know, sort of volcanic experiences. So, you know, with training, particularly some like somatic experiencing, you basically learn how to navigate your own traumatic responses. And so one of some beautiful, very simple key principles is learning how to ground, what they call resourcing, right? So whenever we get triggered, and it could be even, you know, just being mildly triggered, you get some annoying email, or you get cut off in traffic, or someone says something mean and you get triggered, you feel hurt, you feel defensive, you feel reactive. The aside from being present to that, one of the most effective things you can do is ground your attention into something that's resourcing, that takes you out of feeling triggered and into the present moment. So it could be, you know, we take some deep breaths, we feel our feet on the floor, we feel our hands, we stand up and walk around. We, you know, we're always doing things to regulate our nervous systems and to come into balance. And so with mindfulness, we can just make that process conscious. And then once we become steady or stable or grounded in the present, then we can bring that quality of kind attention to then working with whatever trigger, whatever feeling, memory, sensation is present. Yeah. So, you know, and then of course, when, you know, as you're doing that work, it's very easy for the trigger to resurface. You know, maybe you're in a conversation, maybe you're in some place that's traumatizing. Maybe you go back, you know, to somewhere where you grew up and it's got some traumatic memories. So, you know, trauma has a way of resurfacing until it's resolved. And but if we can learn how to resource ourselves and ground, and then when we learn to what's called titrate the attention, we bring our attention to what's triggering. But if as soon as it's too much, too overwhelming, too difficult, then we shift the attention to something, not the trauma, something resourcing. It's the same that in a way we can do with physical pain. When the physical pain is too much, we can shift the attention to something that's not painful, the breath, the sensation in the hands, the sound of traffic or the birds, or we open our eyes and we take in the view out the window. It's a way of orienting so we're not getting overwhelmed with the inner stimulus. So some skills like that sound very simple, and they are simple, but they're radically profound, because what they do is they empower the person to know that they can find a way to feel grounded even when there's turbulent emotions and difficult material arising.
And this is a practice, constant practice to work on grounding for someone who is new in the mindfulness space. How should they remind themselves to have all these grounding practices? What would be the best approach for someone to stick to all these practices?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, we all, this is something that's not, this is something quite natural. So we all know instinctively what's good for us. So in England, where I grew up, the national resourcing custom is to have a cup of tea, no matter what the problem is. Oh, let's have a cup of tea. And that's kind of a way of sort of resourcing. You know, someone comes over and they're telling you problems. Oh, let's have a cup of tea and talk about it. And it's sort of like, you know, this warm liquid that's sort of pleasant tasting, right? So anything that's pleasant, anything that brings you into the present moment, it could be listening to music, it could be walking in your garden, it could be rubbing your hands, it could be looking out the window and gazing at clouds, it could be, you know, sitting with a friend, it could be taking some deep breaths, it could be lying on the earth, right? In many, many ways that we can feel grounded and relaxed and particularly oriented to something that's pleasing. Like right now I'm in my house and I'm looking at this wildflower arrangement that a friend brought over, and I'm noticing the light in the lilacs and the deep velvet of the rose and these crimson cherries. And, you know, no matter what's going on, if I focus on the rose, the only thing that's happening in that moment is the rose. And so if what, you know, say there's a lot of agitated energy in my body, if I'm focusing on the rose, it allows my attention to shift away from it, which actually usually allows the agitation to settle. And then once we're settled, then we can go, oh, what's going on? My body's really agitated. And then we can bring some curiosity to that.
Do you sometimes get a cup of tea whenever you feel agitated?
Oh, I drink tea all day. It's very soothing.
Well, what kind of tea do you drink?
Well, you know, I'm English, so I drink a good Assam or English breakfast tea or something like that. Black tea.
And so in the very beginning of this conversation, you mentioned you wake up at 5 a.m. So what do you do in the first few minutes of your waking up? Let's say in the first 60 minutes of your waking up.
Yeah, well, I happen to be very lucky living in a house that faces east, and our house overlooks the bay. And so the lights are very beautiful in the morning. And so I get up and open up the curtains and usually go sit on the balcony and look at the water's usually very still in the morning. Look at the colors, look at the dawn, look at the sunrise, make a cup of tea as one does, and sometimes do yoga and a little stretching. And then you may or may not know, in my morning, so I get up, have my tea, stretch, yoga, we look at the beautiful colors, say hello to the cats who usually need feeding. And then I lead a morning sunrise practice. So since the pandemic started, I've had a sunrise meditation practice that I lead over Zoom, because I was asked in early March if I could do something for people stuck at home. And I said, yeah, I'll lead some meditations for a week, because we thought, you know, the pandemic will be over in a few weeks. So I'll lead a meditation for a week. And then the pandemic continued. So I led it for another week. And then it was a month. And then it's like, oh, it's 2 months.
Been a year.
Now it's been, now I'm into my 16th month. And yeah, so Monday through Friday, I get up and I hop onto my rooftop and open up my laptop and lead a sunrise mindfulness-based nature meditation, which is very delightful. And people call in, like today, someone was calling from India, China, Sweden, England, Canada. It's very global. And yeah, it's been a lovely thing to be offering that in the morning. And, you know, I would generally meditate on my own. So it's, I just choose to meditate with this global nature meditation community. I give a little guidance here and there, but mostly it's sitting and just enjoying the sounds of nature, the bird song, the breeze, the light, the smells, the air, and, you know, and talk about resourcing. You know, for me, and I think for many people, the primary resource that we have as a mammal is nature. And so for most people, nature is resourcing in that when we go outside, even if it's on a balcony or in a garden or in a park, or even the nature that's on your street in the form of a tree or looking up at the clouds in the sky and the wind and the rain or the sun, nature is very grounding because it's usually very soothing. And it's also often mostly very beautiful. And it's dynamic and it's engaging and it pulls us into the present, right? Where you know, you're sitting in meditation and like I am in the morning, and then, you know, one of the Buick wrens starts calling, or the jays or the crows start chattering, and I'm immediately brought into the present moment, coming out of the cloud of thoughts. In the same way, when the breeze kisses my face or the sun comes out of the clouds, I feel the warmth on my skin and the air is fresh and fragrant. And so all those things bring us into the present. And mostly when we come into the present in our senses, particularly in nature, it's grounding and resourcing, which is why we tend to feel so much better in nature, why we think more clearly, why we're more creative, why we go to the beach, why we go to the park, because we feel better. You know, it's a natural resource.
And how many minutes of meditation practice do you have personally on a daily basis?
Yeah, I like to sit about half an hour. Half an hour seems to be sort of a good, comfortable daily practice. You know, often when I'm sitting, I'll choose to sit longer than that, but I tend to aim for about half an hour. When I'm on retreat, it's much longer, but I usually have, as do most people, things to do, emails, work, meetings, and whatnot. So half an hour seems to be a good enough time to, you know, drop in and develop some presence and embodiment and awareness. And
while growing up, who did you want to be? Did you want to be a meditation mindfulness teacher, or did you have other dreams?
Yeah, you know, I didn't really have much of a future orientation. I didn't aspire in that way. I looked at what my dad did, and my dad was in catering, and I thought, well, you know, I was raised, you know, working class boy from the north, and you tend to just kind of do what your family does. And my family was mostly military, and my dad was in catering, and I wasn't going to go into the military. So I went, signed up for catering school and learned chefing and whatnot. And then one thing to another, I ended up going to college and then getting in, studying sociology and psychology. And then was the natural next step for me doing that was to do some, you know, care work, social work, and ended up becoming a social worker. So it was really just, you know, one foot after the other. And I came to the States, and then actually it was after the working through some of my trauma that I realized, and I'd just been asked to start teaching meditation. This was in the late 90s. And I said, and I decided for myself that I wasn't comfortable teaching Dharma or meditation until I'd got more formal psychological training. So I went back to college and got a master's in clinical psychology and became a therapist and started integrating meditation and psychology. And so, you know, and in the meditation tradition that I'm in, the insight meditation tradition, you're invited to teach. So there's no track. There's no like graduate track to become a teacher. Now there's all kinds of different ways you can teach meditation. But back when I was practicing, the only way you would become a teacher is if you were invited by a teacher to train with them. And so, and I was by my first Vipassana teacher, Christopher Titmus, in England. And then later when I came to the States by Jack Kornfield. And then at some point it was like, okay, yeah, that would be, that makes sense that I teach meditation. I've been doing it long enough and know something, not too much, but know enough just to get into trouble. And then being able to be both a therapist and a meditation teacher felt like a nice combination, because I could really support people on different dimensions.
I have seen some beautiful testimonials from Jack Kornfield in your work. How did you connect with Jack?
Yeah, so I came to Spirit Rock. So my former partner, we met in India, and she was American, and we came to the States, and she was connected to Spirit Rock. I'd been through training there. And so I came to Spirit Rock and met Jack then and had a very lovely connection, and then just got to know him through various friends, and, you know, started studying with him a little bit, and then, you know, really got to know him in the teacher training. It was a 4-year training, and there was only 8 of us. And so it was a very intimate, personal, up close training, and it was a beautiful 4 years. And so became friends and then taught together some, and then he invited me to share his weekly class, and our lives have sort of interwoven ever since. We both now run mindfulness teacher trainings, and So our lives have continued to overlap, including at Spirit Rock, where it's a home base for both of us, Spirit Rock Meditation Center.
Yeah, Jack is like a godfather in the mindfulness space.
Right. Yeah.
So definitely. So what have you learned from him in your experience, if you don't mind sharing with us?
Yeah, Jack has, you know, he's very multifaceted. And I think training with him, you know, in his very up close, intimate way, you know, I learned about irreverence. He's got a wonderful iconoclastic irreverent side. And I learned about the importance of humor and not taking ourselves too seriously, not thinking we're special. And, but particularly, you know, one of Jack's great gifts is his integration of psychology into Buddhism and an evolving Buddhist psychology and integrating the heart. You know, if you look at his books, most of his books have the name heart, you know, Path with Heart, and Seeking the Heart of Wisdom, which was my first Buddhist book that I loved, and by him and Joseph Goldstein, who I also study with a lot. And so I particularly appreciated him integrating the personal, the psychological trauma, the emotional dimensions, and also the householder dimensions. You know, this insight meditation came from a monastic lineage in Thailand and Burma, and Jack was really showing the way of how to live an awakened life as a householder, someone with a family, with children, with work responsibilities. And so it was a very integrated form of Dharma practice, meditation practice. You know, I studied in Asia and, you know, mostly in intensive retreats, and they don't translate so well to living a daily life, you know. And so it's important that teachers and teachings were speaking to how do you wake up in your life, in family, in relationship, in society, with social justice issues and facing the ecological crisis and dealing with race and racism that's systemically ingrained here and all of that. And so Jack, I appreciated the way that he would integrate all of that into one's practice rather than just thinking of it as being, you know, meditation being this cocoon one enters into and as a way of sort of leaving the world, actually allows us to engage more deeply and intimately in the world with wisdom and compassion.
I would like to touch upon the context of meditation in relationships, to be specific, in romantic relationships. So how can meditation help us in cultivating more deeper, rich romantic relationships?
Romantic relationships specifically, or yes, any relationship?
Either or both. You can take, yeah, any stand.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, they're on a continuum. I think any romantic relationship is, in essence, a healthy relationship that, you know, and I think any relationship involves, by necessity, you know, awareness, self-awareness, and awareness of the other, ability to have empathy and understanding and compassion. And so, you know, I personally don't know how people do relationship without mindfulness. You know, it's, you know, without mindfulness, without self-awareness, one is unconscious of how one is. And if you're unconscious of how you are in relationship, then you're probably not acting so wisely. You're probably acting out unconscious habits and biases and prejudices and assumptions and expectations. And so, you know, human relationships are very complex, very intricate and subtle.
It is.
And so the more awareness we can bring to our intention, to our communication, to assumptions, to our views and opinions and judgments about people, you know, the more that we can be aware of that, then the less we are going to be reactive, less we are going to be acting out, less we're going to be blaming and shoulding and dumping our stuff over somebody. And so, yeah, for me, without mindfulness, there's no awareness. And without awareness, and you get into trouble. And of course, that becomes intensified in a romantic relationship, especially if you're living together. And so it becomes its own sort of intensive mindfulness practice, sort of like a monastic practice, in that you're, you know, in this intensive situation with someone, especially during the pandemic. You know, relationships either were made or broken during the pandemic. There was a huge spike in the rate of divorce. But, you know, for myself, I'm in relationship, and for many of my friends, the pandemic and being forced to, you know, in my case, be home more because I normally travel a lot for my work. You know, it's a very beautiful deepening of relationship and a deepening of love and intimacy and connection. But I think if you don't have the, you know, if you haven't trained the mind and cultivated the heart and learned how to be patient and forgiving and kind and fluid and flexible, then yeah, a pandemic could be, as it has been for many, a hell realm, stuck in the same room or the same house with someone you don't get along with so well.
Yes. And in the context of relationships, I struggle to differentiate or to understand the differences between intimacy and connection. So do you have any thoughts on what is intimacy and what is connection?
Yeah, well, I mean, they're sort of interwoven. You know, connection creates intimacy, intimacy creates connection. I don't know if I can come up with a definition of intimacy, but certainly when two people know how to be real and honest and undefended and curious, there's some important conditions that support intimacy: honesty, integrity, truthfulness, and all those qualities, you know, really support connection.
And in your work, I read that you bring mindfulness to be free from the inner critic. We all have inner critic sometimes, that inner voice, that judgment towards ourselves. So how do we work towards resolving that inner critic and befriending that inner critic? Any concrete practices that come into your mind?
Yeah, no, it's something I've been teaching for many, many years. In my book, Make Peace With Your Mind, is really all about that. And there's many, many practices, mindfulness being a key. You know, the subtitle of that book is How Mindfulness and Compassion Can Help Free You from the Inner Critic. And those two qualities, mindfulness, the awareness of your thoughts, noticing them, naming and being clear when the critic is present, you know, learning to be able to distinguish between a judging thought. When I use the word judging thought, there's an assumption within the judging thought that an assumption or an implication about our value say the judgment is, you know, you had a bad meditation, you're very distracted, or whatever the judge is saying. The implication with the judgment is that therefore you should feel shame, bad, wrong, stupid, less than, deficient. And so it's important we notice the difference between judgments and discernments. We can do that through mindfulness. And to be really clear with mindfulness, when a judgment's happening, to name it, to notice it. Joseph Goldstein gave me a practice once of counting the judgments in a day. That was a fun practice, just to see how pervasive and prolific the critic is. You know, there's many, many things to say. One of the most important things to understand is that the critic is a point of view. The critic is an opinion. It's a perspective. And when we understand it's just a point of view that has a very particular angle, one that is negative, one that is distorted, one that is biased to seeing only our negative, problematic, in its opinion, faults, then we can start to see, oh, it's just a bunch of thoughts. It's just ideas. It's just a view. It's not reality. It's just an opinion. So when we have that clarity, then it's a little easier to hold it with some more perspective. This, in the same way that another great strategy is humor, when we can find the humor in it, like our critic will often tell us, oh, sleep in, you need to sleep, it's good for your brain, all the signs now is you should sleep. So you sleep in, and then when you wake up at 10 o'clock, it's like, why are you sleeping in? You didn't meditate, you're late for work, you're always slacking off. And so, you know, or I exaggerate the critic, yes, I'm the worst meditator that ever lived in the world. And so just holding some sense of humor with it, some lightness. So, and then of course, loving kindness, you know, when we can counteract the critic with kind statements rather than judging statements, that's very important. So rather than saying, you know, you're terrible, you're hopeless, you're unlovable, nobody likes you, you offer yourself a statement of kindness, like, may I be happy? May I be free from judging? May I be peaceful? And so there's ways that we can counteract that. We're basically replacing the judging thought with a negative thought. And of course, there's understanding. And we understanding that the critic arises because we usually feel vulnerable. The critic is doing a misguided attempt to protect us. And but it tries to do that with shaming and judgment. And when we do that, we curtail the capacity for understanding what's going on. So it's important that we, you know, see that, and yeah, and with the seeing of that, it creates space in the mind, creates space in the heart. And we can meet ourselves, we meet the vulnerability with kindness rather than judging and shame.
Thank you for explaining, Mark. And fast forward, I want to ask you about what gives you joy in life. What? How do you cultivate joy and happiness? One, I know one is kayaking. And what are other things, activities that you do to cultivate joy?
Oh, many things. You know, I think the gift of someone who meditates and has, you know, is able to be present and aware is that in every moment has the potential for joy. There's so much beauty in the world. There's so much goodness in the world. There's so much natural beauty and wonder. And so when we're present, when we're awake, you know, partly it's a question of turning our attention to what is here that brings delight, that brings beauty, that brings joy. And for me, it's, you know, kind of anywhere and everywhere, whether it's the shape of a leaf, or the light touching the telegraph pole that I'm looking at outside, or the sound of the wind rustling in the treetops, or, you know, so I think it's important that we learn to find those simple joys that are really come down to a quality of attention. And of course, because many other things that bring me joy, you know, including meditation at times, and obviously being outside in nature and the silence of the mornings and being with friends and, you know, good music and dancing and being in my body. And since I just went out, was taken for dinner the other night, and it's like, oh, eating is a joyful experience in a restaurant where you can actually go without a mask and be served delicious food that you didn't cook. And so there are many, many doorways for joy. But for me, the main portal is nature. And then, you know, being with loved ones and dear friends. And yeah.
Could you recommend some of the resources in terms of books or online to cultivate the quality of awareness and attention in our day-to-day lives?
Well, as you know, there's a lot of material out there these days. As you know, mindfulness books are very prolific, and yeah, there's a whole number. I have to mention my own, since I spent the last year writing one called From Suffering to Peace, The True Promise of Mindfulness, and it's a really deep exploration of mindfulness. My friend Diana Winston has a lovely book called The Little Book of Awareness. And I'm just thinking about recent books that have come out that I've appreciated. My friend Harry Cohen has a book called Invitation to Meditation, also very easy, accessible book to read. You know, if you want a deeper dive, Joseph Goldstein has a wonderful, thorough exploration of mindfulness called Mindfulness. So that's be a good starting point for some listeners.
All right. And is there anything else that we should have covered and we didn't cover?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there could be many things. It might be another podcast episode, but nothing that comes to mind. I would just encourage people to, you know, my life these days is teaching mindfulness in nature. And I just highly encourage people to get away from their screens, to unplug, to get outside. We're becoming an indoor species. You know, 95% of our time indoors. We're becoming a screen species. The average hours now on a screen is 11 hours a day. And just very important to get outside, move your body, come into the more than human world, come into a perspective of sky and space and light and color and sound and smell and touch, and see what that does for both awareness, presence, well-being, joy, connection, love. Very important.
And last but not least, where can we find you online?
Yeah, people can. My main website is my name, markcoleman.org, markcoleman.org. And I have my, retreat calendar and lots of free resources, meditations, talks on mindfulness and nature and all kinds of other information about my books and whatnot. And then my other main website is awakeinthewild.com, which is where my meditation nature work is featured. And I have many teachers who are also now teaching that work. And I run a nature teacher training. You can find out information about that through Awake in the Wild. And then the third website, I sadly have too many websites, is the Mindfulness Training Institute. And Mindfulness Training Institute runs annual year-long mindfulness teacher training. So if anybody's interested in deepening their practice and teaching, highly recommend it. We do it 1 year in Europe. So then this coming September, we're in France. And every other year, we're in the Bay Area teaching that. I teach that with my friend and colleague, Martin Aylward. But the easiest thing to do is just go to markcoleman.org and it's all there.
Great. And I will put all the links in the show notes at nishantgarg.me/podcast. So Mark, thank you so much for...
You're welcome, Nishant. Nice to be with you. Good to talk.
Thank you for listening to this podcast episode today. If you did enjoy this, please subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, or you can visit https://nishantgarg.me. nishantgarg.me. You can also share this episode with your loved ones to help them live a fulfilled life. You are not alone in this journey. We all struggle in life. There is no shame in talking about it. I go through my highs and lows. I get depressed, and these practices help me in living a resilient life. You can also do this. You've got this. Don't judge yourself. You are doing the best you can. And thank you so much again.